Hi, this is Michelle Grace Hoddle, architect for I've Never Met a Woman Architect Before. Thank you to Lowen Windows and Doors for sponsoring this podcast. Lowen Windows and Doors offer some of the highest performing fenestration products in the most demanding climates. They are also a true partner of the architectural community by supporting AIA chapters nationwide. I'm here today with Tom Kunde. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Michelle.
Tom Kundig, FAIA-RIBA, is a principal, owner, and founder of Olson Kundig. Tom has received some of the world's highest design honors, including a National Design Award in Architecture from the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum, an Academy Award in Architecture from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and an election to the National Academy as an academician? I'm sorry, Tom.
That's all right. I can't okay. Say it either.
Okay, in architecture, known for his contextual approach to design, Kundig emphasizes the primacy of the site. Its buildings are a direct response to place, often serving as a backdrop to the built cultural or natural landscapes that surround them. Tom's ongoing work includes private homes, hospitality projects, workplaces, and adaptive reuse projects around the globe. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Michelle. Honored to be here. Actually, I'm also now working on sports venues. How's that for strange?
Okay. What kind of sports venues?
Well, gotta kind of keep that quiet, but it's actually one that I don't have to. LeBron James Innovation Center at Nike started in the sports arena, and it's a completely fascinating career for me personally to get to work on all these different kinds of projects, get invited by particularly interesting clients, and they want something maybe a little bit different. And that's why we get invited to these venues that we would never have guessed we would ever work on.
Well, that's great. That's great. Yeah. So I had the opportunity to meet Tom when he was a speaker at the AIA CRAN Symposium, and it was great. I just loved all of the things that he's had to say about residential architecture and about how it's kind of like the research and development lab for his other projects. So, Tom, what are your first recollections of experiencing architecture?
Well, that's actually, of course, kind of an interesting question. Those of you who know, my dad was an architect. So it's actually, I don't even know. I probably was like super young, but I, as many may know, once I began to understand architecture, the culture of architecture, I kind of avoided it for all sorts of reasons. Who knows what, why, but, my experiences, a lot of them had to do with going on to construction sites or then going back to the buildings after they were built. Let's say if there was a church that my family was part of, if I think about the question, I think about, okay, what did I see as a kid growing up young under construction? And then what did I experience? And I think a church I grew up in, and then a cabin, of course, that is particularly influential for my career.
I have three kids and their dad was an architect, and none of them want to go into architecture. But I mean, right, they're still young. When did you go into it then?
Well, yeah, I very much resisted. I started at the university and I had an agenda that was more science-based. I continue to be fascinated with sciences, and hard sciences in particular. Physics was one that felt most comfortable to me. And so there's this sort of, it sort of straddles engineering and physics. And I just found it kind of fascinating as a kid. So when I went to the university, I just started taking the usual sort of background classes that you would do with an idea that it somehow I might wind up in doing something like geophysics. I just knew some people that were in it. I found it completely fascinating. But I also discovered soon on that that was just not an agenda that really made 100% sense to me, whatever that means. When somebody says, you know, you just don't feel it. And if you're, you know, we'll go, I mean, we can honestly answer questions about why would you become an architect? Or people always ask me, you know, the kid wants to be an architect just like you. And, you know, do you have recommendations? And, you know, my answer is always the same. You know, it used to be, I would say, oh, you know, I really think hard about it because it's a heck of a commitment. And it is a heck of a commitment. But you know it when it is the only thing you can do, if that makes sense. And was weird for me to go through that transition of understanding all of a sudden, no, architecture actually is part of me. It feels comfortable. It is comfortable. I just had a sense for it, and I just made, obviously, ultimately the complete commitment to it. And that's what you have to do with architecture to survive at any level. You just have to make a complete, you shoulder in complete, completely into the architecture, into the profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, my daughter, she kind of, when she did all the testing, they said that she should go into architecture. And, you know, she said, oh, I don't want to do that. Even though it was like the top thing, she said, no, I don't want to do that. And her dad said, like, well, you know, it's like you do architecture because you can't do anything, you know, because you don't, you know, it's like there isn't, you do it because that's like, you can't not do it. Yeah. So that was kind of, you know. Yeah.
Well, you guys are right on a point, which is the point I'm always trying to make. You're going to be, your soul is going to be crushed. You know, there are so many reasons, you know, to just get out of architecture. But if it's really something, it's just like an actor or a musician. I mean, there are so many, those are all tough professions to follow. And there's all sorts of reasons to give up. And go into something else. But honestly, if you can get past, as you know, if you can get past those soul crushing moments in your career, whether it's in academics or whether it's in the profession, I think it's truly one of the most exciting, personally rewarding professions I could imagine.
Mm-hmm. I think my soul still gets crushed. Maybe I'm just too sensitive.
Yeah. Well, that, okay. Fair point. That happens for the rest of your career.
So what are three classic buildings that you like and why?
Well, I got to remember now, but I think I picked.
I have a reminder too.
Yeah. Well, of course, a Scarpa building would be important to me. And, Brion, it's interesting when I look back and I looked back at what I chose, that two of them are sort of a lot about mystery, right? It's either a sacred mystery or it's a life mystery, life and death. Of course, the Brion Cemetery is all about that. And I think Scarpa, again, just on a artistic, you know, just a soulful level. When you go, it you feel the nature of what this place is all about. Ultimately, you know, the life, and death, underground, mm-hmm. underwater, above ground, above water. I mean, I don't even quite know how to describe it in narrative form, but when you visit the site, and the first time I visited Brion, I was by myself. There was nobody else there. It was all gloomy weather, and it just couldn't be more powerful to actually walk through the spaces and experience what Scarpa had put together. My takeaway was it was all about the mystery of life. And that, especially with death, you know, what happens? It's the ultimate mystery. And It wasn't answering questions. It was almost asking questions in a sense, or provoking, you know, some sort of sense of what it means. So Brion always has been a very important place for me. But of course, Scarpa, just his architecture in general, hugely impactful. When I was first discovered him, I'm old enough that Scarpa was really not that well known in the academic realm. But there was a professor that worked a lot in Italy, and she said, you know, I think you should look at this work. I think it's important to you. So somehow she sensed that it would resonate with me. And oh, absolutely. In a nanosecond, it did. And of course, when I could, I visited the site. As it turns out, my dad, as an architect at the ETH in Zurich, actually went in the 50s, middle 50s, still probably, maybe early 50s. I don't even know what years. Down to Italy with his class to meet with Carlos, So he was, you know, of course he was an academic, but he was he was certainly well known back in the 50s, and then he disappeared, but now he was just reintroduced, and of course he's hugely influential in the industry.
I went to the Eric Gunnar Asplund crematorium in Stockholm, you know, in Sweden. And I mean, I've always liked those things, or the one, the cenotaph. I mean, I like those, I don't know, those spaces too. I mean, I don't know whether it's like, I mean, who knows, right?
It's hard to explain.
We're definitely full of life, right? We're not like downers, but we just really like those spaces. Yeah.
No, it's like hugely, it's exciting. It's interesting that as architects, we don't really do very well. At least I haven't done that very many sacred site. I mean, you could argue that the landscapes are sacred, but that's a whole different. But really where, we as a species have really formulated these places with these mysteries, and we're actually intellectually just, it's our life. We know that our life has a beginning and an end, and it's constant about, you know, where we fit and what is important and what is out there. What are the unanswered questions? You know, you don't typically get to work on very many of those venues. And then the second project was, the chapel and
convent, right?
Yeah. And it was, it's interesting because, again, it's about the mystery. I'm not Catholic. You know, I was raised in a religion that would not be considered Christian. I guess it isn't. So I come in from the outside, but of course, it doesn't really matter what your sort of program is. You're still, all have these sort of spiritual senses of, what. Is ultimately the mystery of life, and just entering the chapel and what was done there. We were there in a very special moment. Again, it was basically just my wife and I, some friends, Max Underwood from Arizona, and he had a special way of getting in there. So it was really just the four of us. And I just sat there looking at, the chapel and of course the proportions, the light, everything was just mystery. So here's the part, Michelle, that just blew me away. And I didn't know about this because I worked with Stephen Hall in St. Ignatius Chapel. I got to know a little bit about what was important in a, in a chapel. And of course, I do think that's a spiritual space also.
Yeah, I've got a, this is a Stephen Hall painting that I picked up from, I've been to that chapel. I love that chapel up there. When I've been in Seattle, probably like a year or two ago. Yes, I just love that chapel. Yeah.
Well, and that is a sacred space. There was a very, very beautiful, moving story on that. And I'll tell that story after talked a little bit about chapel. I forgot the name of the chapel. I got a metal block right now.
Capuchin?
Yeah.
C-A-P-U-C-H-I-N?
Yeah, Capuchin order or nuns, you know. Anyway.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not Catholic. But
there was, I'm not Catholic either.
But it was such a spiritual experience. In fact, I even teared up, which my wife said, I've never seen you tear up for architecture. And obviously it was an emotional sort of moment. But what, you know, there's only one cruciform that's basically allowed in a Catholic chapel or church that you see. And that's important. And what Barragán did was he had a cross out in the courtyard. And I sat there for quite a while, and all of a sudden I sort of sensed, almost like the ghost, you know, of course, you know, the Trinity, the shadow of that cross was working its way across the back wall. And it was like, again, it was like Brion was the mystery, the quiet mystery of a sacred moment, a very personal sacred moment where you're alone with your thoughts. You know, we come in alone and we leave alone. So those are the moments that as architects, it's such a privilege to be involved in something like that. Quick story about if I could indulge me on a story about Stephen Hall's chapel. Again, a heck of an honor to work on that project with Stephen and Tim. So I was local, so I was there to sort of assist in delivering this building, and the delivery was actually complicated, of course, politically complicated. Catholic Church is a very complicated political group. And the Jesuits, yes. The Jesuits were of course, the supporters of it. And the Jesuits, even as an order, are complicated in the Catholic Church. But it was very clear that there were a number of Catholics. And for an architect, this is really interesting. There were a number of Catholics that didn't think what Stephen was designing was a Catholic church. Stephen's not a Catholic either. And that was interesting that the Jesuits would hire a non-Catholic because they wanted it that way so that the architect didn't come in with the burden of a Catholic upbringing.
Any preconceived notion of what it would 100%, be like.
100%. Yeah. They saw it as an academic exchange. Jesuits, naturally. Well, they had also interviewed Moshe Safdie for the chapel. So just give you an idea of how interesting this group was, the Jesuits were, about opening up, you know, a dialogue of some kind. So, but there was a part of the Catholic community that was really up in arms about what was being proposed. It was abstract. It was weird looking. It didn't feel like a Catholic church. It was I heard words like evil and, you know, whatever. And I was kind of I got a lot of those arrows because I was local. So I saw a lot of that and I tried to, of course, mitigate that. Fortunately, you know, the Jesuit group that we were working with was able to mitigate a lot of those things. The chapel was built. There was one particular spearhead point person, forgot her name. Well, I shouldn't use her name anyway, because she was really tough and she led the anti-scheme group. Was extremely vocal and aggressive. the interesting thing was when Father Murphy blessed the chapel, there was maybe a couple of hundred people there. She was there and she came up to me and she, the tears were streaming down her eyes. And she said, I was wrong for 2 years. This is, in fact, a sacred place. Because she sensed what Stephen had done there as, again, what Brion does, what Barragan did in Mexico City, Stephen did in Seattle, is make an architecture that moved your soul. And, you know, it's interesting how difficult that is to convince people. You know, when it's on paper, when it's in model form, when it's in a narrative, until it happens. And then when it happens, it becomes, of course, a sacred place.
Mm-hmm. It's always interesting because, you know, there'll always be, I mean, really, as long as there, I mean, there are the ceremonial elements of the architecture. And I think if people can take that preconceived, like traditional notion of what that is, because in that chapel, it still has all the elements of, you know, of the religion, you know, it's just not what they typically see, but all of those elements are there, right? It's not maybe in a cruciform plan where it has all that, but it still has the, you know, the ceremony and all of those other, you know, the spaces that are included in that religion. So that's kind of, you know, I think sometimes people have to get by that, right? They have to get by that preconceived notion of what something is, but to actually 100%. Feel those elements that are in fact, you know, in this architecture.
Yeah, 100%. And honestly, I'm not always sure, how to sort of harvest those moments. I mean, people have sacred moments in natural landscapes.
Absolutely.
There are elements of the natural landscape. Not typically, I mean, typically you don't have, I don't think, a sacred moment in the center of an urban, you know, Times Square or something like that. That's a different sort of thing because it's a very personal moment. And again, an honor for any architect to be involved in a project that touches on the most human thing, which is, where you are in the world, which I think is, of course, really exciting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that's a beautiful space. And then the other one was the one in, is it Bagno Reggio?
Bagno Reggio. Yeah. Yes. But it's... I got a metal block. I'm thinking Castle Vecchio. It's not Castle Vecchio.
No, it's Civita.
Bagno Reggio. Yeah. What was it? I'm sorry.
Civita.
Civita.
Civita. Okay.
Yeah. And that's almost a little embarrassing because I've spent quite a bit of time there, but I kept thinking Castle Vecchio. It's not Castle Vecchio. It's Civita. And or Civita. And Civita is
a
very special place for me, for a lot of us from the University of Washington or the Pacific Northwest. We were one of our mentors. In fact, Stephen Halls, one of his mentors, was Oster Zarina. She was a character. She was straight out of La Dolce Vita. And she was Lithuanian, but lived in Rome and actually taught at the University of Washington. And she basically went from the University of Washington and started the Rome program and the Hilton program. And so she and her husband, Tony, found this place, Civita. No motorized vehicles, or theoretically there are no motor, because the only way you can get there is with a donkey path, a donkey bridge. So everything comes in, or used to come in with donkeys on. Probably electric vehicles now. Very small, kind of a ruin, and just an unbelievable little spot in the natural world. So for me personally, it spoke volumes to my geophysics kind of sense and mountain climbing sense of the natural world and how it emerges out of the ground, because literally these outcroppings come out of the ground, and literally the buildings are made with the same material. So it's just this direct one-to-one relationship to the natural world. And there's, I've just spent a fair bit of time there. And again, the natural world is the natural world. It's hugely impactful for me personally, having grown up in it. But when the natural world is sort of poetically moved or built or whatever, it's just these are the Greek hill towns, the Italian hill towns, of course, the Anasazi locations in the Southwest.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, there's just this. It's not a bifurcation between us and them or us and natural world. It's where humans have just so naturally emerged out of the natural landscape, which is we forget we're part of that natural landscape. I think the human beings have made that mistake of sort of divorcing themselves from the natural landscape or our mm-hmm. roots. I mean, we really mm-hmm. are just part of the genetic stuff. You know, we're stardust, basically. And I think we sometimes forget, again, geophysics is very much about that. It's cosmology and whatever, where you just really understand that, we are part of this natural order. And I think a place like Civita just emphasizes that. And it's stunningly beautiful. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes. The only one that I've ever been to that's been up on that was my daughter studying Alicante for a semester. And then I went and visited her, and then she kind of closed up her apartment or whatever. But I had come in late. I barely got any, right? I basically just rested on the floor in the Madrid airport until I could get a flight out, because I'd come in at like 11 o'clock. I couldn't get a flight out until 5 o'clock. So just sitting there in front of that one sculpture that they have in the Madrid airport that I forget who it's by. But anyway, I was just like sitting in front of the Chinese. And then, you know, I maybe had a few, flew down there, and my daughter's like, oh, okay, you can sleep for a few hours. And then she's like, okay, now we're going to go up to see the castle on the top. So on 3 hours sleep, I'm like Yikes. Trying to get up the hill for that. And of course they were moving. I mean, her and her friends were just right. Like,
of course, just young and energetic,
practically running.
That'll leave a mark. Well, you know, I would recommend if you, of course, Italy is so important for all of us. And
yes,
two of my projects are, you know, that I picked are in Italy. And actually, I was going to, Maison de Verre is obviously hugely impactful, but it's already been, it was already chosen by another architect. So I knew I had to go to somewhere else, but then it's France. But
okay. And Fougeron, right? I think Anne Fougeron did it. I think she had it. So many people, like the Sydney Opera House. So many people have said the Sydney Opera House.
Hilarious.
So, no, this is great. This is great because none of these have been chosen before.
Oh, I'm glad. Well, because I looked at the others with Larry and all just sort of picked out. I go, yeah, well, geez, of course. These are important for all of us. I would recommend, and when you do go back to Italy, it's outside of Rome. It's a couple of outside of Rome. Unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to see it, it now has been discovered. And it's a little bit overrun, but in the 70s, no one knew about Civita. And I forgot it was Goethe, I think. Somebody asks, I'm probably wrong on that. Somebody asked back in the 1700s, where Civita, what's this Civita? Where is it? And the answer was, and this is the same thing, it's a classic reveal moment when you see it, because you go, and what he said was, go to Bagnareggio, walk down the main street, and there it will be. And it's so true, because you can't see it. You can't see it. You go through Bagnareggio and it's kind of confusing. It's another hill town. And then, boom, it's just this unbelievably beautiful. And the fact that it only in the last 15, 20 years has become popular to visit has always been kind of a surprise to me. Because I always, historically, I always recommend to other friends, oh, when you go there, you got to go to Civita. And they go in the car, yeah, okay. But some of them actually went and they came, oh my God, that was a moment, you know, it was a moment I'll never forget in my life. So just a recommendation.
Okay. I'll go the next time. I don't know when I'll be getting to Europe again, but but definitely. So of course, I mean, what do you like about being an architect?
I can't imagine a profession that engages our place, our life more completely. The people we meet, the places we go to, the things we're dealing with, but all the way from nerdy technology to just ultimate spiritual poetry. And everything in between, is there a profession and affect human beings? We're not, I always say, we don't save people's lives, but we change people's lives. Can you imagine a profession that has more sort of soulful impact on yourself personally, but on the community at large, on the human race? That for me, it's an unlimited canvas in a way. You know, I've been at this almost my whole life, I've kind of been around it. I was exposed to artists, which were hugely impactful to me. Yeah. I was exposed to natural landscapes and buildings, even though I didn't want to be an architect. So there was naturally some exposure. But once I became an architect, it was like a crescendo where all of a sudden I realized, oh, this is an adventure that everybody should have in their lives. Obviously, not everybody can be an architect, but what an adventure. After doing this for 40, 45 years now, I just can't believe how lucky I am.
Yeah. And I mean, it definitely affects. I mean, I know my kids have definitely been influenced, but it's funny because, you know, somebody will say something and then they'll kind of like go on to like tell them about it, like architecturally. And the people are like looking at them like, what? Like, why? Like, how do you know this stuff?
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, don't be surprised when they come back and say, well, you know, I'm kind of thinking about taking some architecture classes.
They have talked about it. You know, it's funny. I mean, I don't know whether you had this thing like did you ever look at your dad and say, oh, I'm never going to be as great as him, so I don't want to do it. And I think that when they're younger, they kind of look and they kind of say, oh, you're successful just because you have a job, right? I mean, you have a career to a younger kid. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to be able to achieve that or whatever. And I always tell them like, oh my gosh, like, I think you're going to achieve much more than I have in my life. You know, I mean, I would hope that you would, or I'd hope at least you would be happy with it. But, you know, I mean, I think that maybe that's sometimes why they maybe don't want, I mean, do you have kids? Did any of your kids decide to go into it?
No, we didn't have kids. So we don't have any architects coming up. But no, I don't know. I don't know. I just didn't, honestly, when I was a kid, I just didn't, it was like, I didn't like the attitude of architects. And, You know, we all recognize that, the sort of sense of entitlement, whatever you want to call it. And I would hear things like, your dad built our building or built our house. And I was a kid and I was going, no, he didn't. Because the builders, there are all these people that were building this stuff. And I just thought, the architects are part of the system, and they're in a privileged position. But I don't know. I just didn't like the way they were talked about and the way they felt about their importance. So I think that was the main reason I was it just avoided getting involved in that. But on the other hand, I just met all these crazy, wonderful people in the profession, like we all do in the business of architecture. Yeah. I met artists, like I was said earlier, artists, musicians, mathematicians, philosophers. Oh my God. And they all had huge impact. And I obviously, my parents were both Swiss, so I'm a Swiss citizen by just accident of birth, basically. But obviously, mm-hmm. the mountains are super important for my mom and dad, and the mountains became really important to me. And my experiences in the mountains have everything to do with my architecture and how I feel mm-hmm. about how I feel about architecture.
In the Swiss mountains or the mountains here too, also.
Mostly here, mostly Cascades, Rocky Mountains, up into Canada. I lived in Alaska mm-hmm. for a couple of years. So mostly West Coast stuff and up into Alaska, Banff, Jasper, that area. Didn't get down to, as a kid, didn't really get down into California and New Mexico that much. Was supposed to go a number of times to Nepal in the 70s to do some particularly important climbs. I was invited, and this is one of my regrets in life, because when people ask me, what do you regret? I say, well, how do you regret? I say, well, the time is short. Do it. If you are invited to do something, do it. Don't wait. It's just not worth it. So for the most part, my life has been that I just did it and found out whatever it was to discover. But in the 70s and early 80s, again, what an honor to be able would have been to go to Pakistan and Nepal at that time and go back in and climb some of the largest mountains in the world. And I just didn't feel I had the money. Or which I didn't, but I could have done something to make it work. But yeah, I was invited as a support climber. Oops, those days are gone.
I don't know. Sometimes I read those stories and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'll just want to get into it.
Well, yeah, but I'm
right, because only the stories that you read are the bad stories, right?
Yeah,
the stories that you read.
Yeah, that's exactly right. For the most part, but yeah, you can put the life and death stuff off to the side a little bit, because that's obviously rare. But what's always true in those endeavors, it's just like architecture. Can't imagine a more difficult profession to actually survive in, physically and emotionally. It's the same thing with mountain climbing. To survive just physically and emotionally, because the work is really hard. There's not much romantic about it, but it's like the efforts you put in and the result. It just makes it all worth it. And the effort that you put into architecture and the commitment and the risk that you're really putting the chips on the table, the rewards are worth a lifetime.
Yeah. So why did you apply for AIA fellowship, and what topic did you choose? Did they have topics back then? I don't know.
Yeah.
How long have you been a fellow?
Well, I should check. It may be 80, 88? I don't even remember anymore. It's a so really like good
question. At least 30 years.
Yeah. It's been a while. Yeah. And it was designed because, you know, I just feel comfortable saying that, you know, that, but I also think design is not just scribbles and, you know, narratives and, you know, parties. I mean, design for me as an architect is actually following all the way through everything, mm-hmm. management of a project, the technical issues, the client relationships. That to me is design. That to me is what architecture is all about. So to pull out, you know, certain parts of that, design to me is the umbrella. And yes, it has to be beautiful. And yes, it has to be impactful. And it has to, you know, have meaning, aesthetic meaning. But in order to get there, you have to understand how to get there and what are the best processes to get there. Your architecture is just more informed the more you understand, you know, the nuances of how to get there, if that makes sense. I worked occasionally for an artist that was my mentor, and he built all his sculptures. And I learned very early as a kid, I knew I wasn't going to be an artist, but what I learned from watching him build his own sculptures, that as he was shaping, you know, the formwork, he was making changes, and he understand how material worked and how you could work it and what you could do and what you couldn't do. And he's just a very skilled fabricator and sort of material, intuitive material scientist. And he could, you know, yeah, sure, you could do a drawing, give it to some fabricator and do it, but you wouldn't take it to this next level, the level mm-hmm. of poetry, I think, and nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So anyway, that's, and I don't remember why I applied for my fellowship, but I did, and yeah, fortunately it worked out. It's, and, you know, obviously an honor.
They didn't kick it back to you, did they? Did they kick it back to you or not? Okay.
I don't recall.
No. There's a lot of people have these stories about how, you know, like, oh, it's like so they kicked it back to me. I had to redo it. And, you know, and there are these people that are like, they're like, I'm always like, what? Like, why would they kick it back? Like, I can't figure out like why. It's like the building department or something.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Oh, or trying to work, trying to get something on the computer when you just, what? I know I'm doing this right. You know, the credit card number has got to be right. And it keeps saying, you know, incomplete, you know, or information is not correct. And,
You scroll up to the top and there's something in red, like, oh, you didn't put your email, email out. Oh, I put a dot instead of an at, and I didn't realize that.
100%. Well, actually, when I lived in Alaska, I got my Alaska license relatively quickly because my business partner and I had started a little firm. And so we needed a license. So I said, okay, I'll try to get the license. And it's notorious up there. You have to write almost like a thesis on Arctic engineering. And there was one architect engineer that reviewed all the theses that were, you had to present for to get your Alaska license. And it was really tough because obviously at some level, they wanted you to understand Arctic engineering for obvious reasons. But also, I think there was a little filter process happening there. So they made it tough. Well, he would never allow anybody to any thesis to be accepted if you misspelled Arctic. And so you had all these architects. They would go, I don't, what am I supposed to do? And now, until you figured out, and I just happened to understand that through the grapevine by somebody else up at the University of Fairbanks or Alaska at Fairbanks, I forgot his name. He was a tough old guy. And he goes, if you didn't spell Arctic right, it wasn't going to square two.
That's why in my head, I always been pronouncing it architect.
Yeah, you have to do it. You just have to do it because it's so simple to miss.
Yeah. So what would you like to say about the future of architecture?
Well, you know, the future is, of course, unknown, and it's interesting. I think, and it always has been evolving. So because I grew up in it, it's interesting. A lot of the same subjects were discussed in the 60s that I overheard that are still with us now. And I doubt that will change. But what's changing in particular, I think, are delivery systems. You know, obviously, you know, I was a pencil and a pen. That was my technology, right? That I grew up with.
Yeah. I still use that.
100%. I still have a May line. It's the way I think. Frankly, if I'm designing, I have to, you know, get out the scale and the triangles and the tools and just start sketching. I just don't feel valid if I'm just sketching without having the scale out and just really getting an idea of what I know about structural systems and efficiencies. And then obviously that worked its way into AutoCAD and, you know, Revit and, you know, all these illustration systems we have now. And it's obviously now with the cell phones, I mean, if there's a revolution, it's the communication devices. I mean, remember when we would be I'm old enough that when I first started working, people were still smoking and, you know, like you'd be on a table, you know, adjacent to or in front of another person, and they'd be just sitting there smoking away, blowing smoke your way. And the messages you got, there was only one phone in the office, and the receptionist would get a message and write it down on a little piece of paper and bring it back to you. And then you go, you know, and so you're trying to do construction administration. And of course, that's the way you did it. And you'd have to go back to the phone and make a little phone call. And it's so much different now. I mean, I can travel the world and communicate with my little phone here. It's hilarious how many things we thought were so cool when they started coming out, like, you know, really getting Xerox machines, really getting particular, you know, whatever, fax machines. That was unbelievable. Now that's just part of our delivery system. I'm not sure it's more efficient. Communication is way more efficient, but I'm not sure communicating the technical delivery is there yet. I mean, with Revit, I look at the drawings that we put out. There's an inefficiency in the drawings where we would, I don't know if you remember this, Michelle, but when you were drawing by hand, you would literally be thinking, how can I make this drawing more efficient? Because otherwise, I'm holding this 9-pound head over my drawings, and it just is physically hard work. So instead of 30 wall sections, how do I do 2 or 3 wall sections that answer virtually all the questions? And yes. So that's on one sheet of paper. Now I get packages, and there's like 30 wall sections, and maybe there's something that's changed them. And it's not indulgent, but it doesn't have the discipline, I think, that we used to just physically needed to have to design a building that was relatively easy to describe. So we didn't get into a bunch of strange geometries, because the possibilities now are almost limitless. And we just had to work with you know, straight 2x4, straight steel. And obviously that's still much more efficient than, you know, some of the other shaping that goes on. So that is a huge difference, is the just from the delivery side of what we do, is the size of the drawings. And of course, the liability is increased, and, you know, there's all sorts
of things. Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally get, like, I did an ADU for myself and I just did one wall section and 100%. Then I turned it, and then the building department had all these questions about it. And I said, it's literally a 12x20 foot building. Yeah. And I said, that's it. And I said, you know, it's raised floor foundation, just like everything, you know, it's just, it's like 20 feet high on the high side going down to 16. I said, it's my project. I said, I have a structural engineer who sized the stuff for it, but it's my project. I'm going to build it. So it's like, why do I need all for this tiny, but it's 240 square feet. It's like, with a sleeping loft that they don't know about. I mean, the sleeping loft is in there, but they don't know exactly what it is, right? Because I'm not going to start putting in stairs.
Actually, they probably know, but they just don't want to ask the question. But, you know, but it's absolutely true, because you with a lot of these small projects, you literally could do two or three sections in a floor plan. And if you're smart, you only, I don't know if you've discovered that, but you answer the issue once. You don't have it in three or four places in the drawings, because then when you change that, then you have to go through every one of those places.
But Tom, that is the thing that the building department keeps bringing up. And I say, no, the way that I was trained is you put it in one spot and that's it. Now, I don't know whether it's because they think, with a computer, it'll just automatically change it wherever. But I don't think it does, right?
I don't think it does either, because, you know, we've gotten caught in a couple of situations where, you know, it's a change order because there's inconsistent information in a couple of places. And of course, you know, if it's inconsistent, why didn't you ask us which one to go? But that's a conversation that is obviously always awkward, but it's also an indicator that if it was in one place, you can fix it once. You know, and you don't have to go through the entire package to find the rest of it. I also think the contractors have got to be sort of like just sick and tired of looking through these, and they get burnt out. If you're looking through a phone book of drawings that are mostly reiterative, if you could really reduce that. Anyway, this is nerdy stuff. It's kind of boring, I'm sure, for your listener, but it is something I think that the future of architecture is, I think, grappling with. And I think the future might be that delivery systems and architecture and actual design will be more efficient. And I mean, obviously with AI right now, it's kind of incredible. It's still infancy right now, but there might be an end game or situation, whatever, where it just becomes a lot more efficient. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing it will be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're doing a little bit of speculative homes, right? You're doing homes for a builder. Are you kind of involved in the building process then? I mean, besides just doing, you know, CA or?
No. Yeah. No, we are definitely involved in more, you know, residences that are being built, designed by us, built by somebody that, you know, maybe hired us to then sell to an unknown client. And the expectations are really high, because the client they're selling to are quite high. And you know, the reason I think that's the case is that a lot of developers or contractors meet with people that don't want to go through the really difficult entitlement process that it takes And the years that it takes to actually design a building, you know, do the fun part, whatever. And then the construction of the projects become, you know, really, you know, 3 years out of your life to design and to construct something. And now it's probably closer to four. You're looking at your kids 4 years older than, and well, in fact, in some jurisdictions, the entitlements might stretch that to 5 years. So what used to take 2 years to 3 years now takes 5 years. Well, that's significant when you look at, you know, people's lives and where they are in their life. And so I think we're doing a little bit of that. It's you know, it's got its pluses and minuses, of course.
Yeah.
But the product is intended to be, you know, first rate, you know, first cabin. Yeah. That's what people are looking for.
Yeah. It's your brand. It's your design. It's just kind of, you know, do you feel like you have more control over the end product then?
No, because it's, you know, at the end of the day, you know, to be frank, it's a financial agenda. So sometimes you lose control on that. When you're working with a client, and I love working with clients personally, that's the best possible scenario for me, because the client, you're especially the residential clients, it's very personal. It's their one time in their life, many of them, that they're going to make this kind of financial, emotional commitment. And they all are different, and all their landscapes are different. All their agendas are different. It's a completely interesting, back to what I was saying earlier, to be on. It's an honor to work in these, you know, these idiosyncratic situations and learn a lot about their industries, learn a lot about their agendas, their culture, because we do work now around the world on a very personal level. That's probably my favorite. And honestly, when I'm working in larger projects, the fewer the personalities I'm working with as clients, the better I personally do, because I'm really, at the end of the day, you know, Charles Morris Partner. I've got a mental block. He said that basically buildings are based, the buildings inherently have the spirit of the people that worked on the project. And it's kind of true, because and that spirit is given back over the lifetime of the building. You know, buildings don't happen they happen with a whole bunch of people. And the, you know, all these people in this weird sort of moment, idiosyncratic time, come together to make this thing. Of course, it's going to be it's going to have its own special spirit, which I think is really exciting. And when you're working with a client personally, it's really a direct link, and you have more opportunity, I think, to carry on a conversation about how you might solve that problem in a more innovative way that would address their question.
Rubel Udell? Is it Rubel? Udell?
No, it was
the other one.
Well, I think maybe or Rubel
after
Udell. It was the begins with an L.
The fourth years.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm embarrassed to say I forgot, but interesting guy. So I think, that's one reason. Back to your first, you know, introduction, the residential arena. In many ways, that's the soul of architecture. As you know, I always quote Glenn Merkitt, who said, you know, the private residence is the architecture the architects have forgotten about, and yet it is the most basic unit of our existence. It's food, water, shelter to survive. It's shelter. It's how we. It's who we are. It's what we are. And, you know, and beyond that, if you understand shelter and what it means to have shelter on all levels, then, you know, your architecture, I think, is going to be ultimately stronger.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Tom. That's going to be the clip right there. That last part, that's going to be the clip that I like to do.
Oh, good.
Perfect.
Took a half hour to get there, I guess, but. Oh, thanks, Michelle. It was I love these, these podcasts to just conversations. To talk about this stuff. And as you know, it always changes. You know, every time you do a podcast or you're interviewed, it's an evolutionary sort of existence. And it's always really great to come back and sort of rearticulate things or just rethink things. Again, why I like small projects, it circles quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, thank you. I'm just gonna and thank you so much to Lowen Windows again. They're known as a leading manufacturer of premium wood and wood clad windows and doors for the luxury architectural market in North America. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.